Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello, and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, stuck in the floorboards here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
I'm Phyllis Gove.
And back with us, Jordan Cruciola. It's so great to have you, Jordan.
I am so happy to be back with you guys, of course. I mean, we started with the most rambunctious possible scenario to have me meet you guys and have me be on this show. Yeah. So we've broken it in. We've broken it in.
100%.
Yeah.
This is going to be pretty rambunctious. I got to tell you, I'm a real Polanski head. So
bold admission in 2020.
No, it's a lie. It's a lie. It's a joke. It's a lie. Yeah.
I want to say though, that like, I didn't know when we came into General's Daughter what we were coming into. I mean, I Kenny and I both watched the film. Both of us had our issues. Anyone who's listened to the episode, listen to the episode.
Yeah.
It's a great episode.
It's a movie mostly lost to time, though. Like,
100%.
It doesn't get trotted really out.
Yes.
100%. Yes. And you came out with the hottest take and just really just, you know, came out guns blazing.
Yeah.
Then I sat down to watch this film, unfortunately, for the third time in my life.
Second for me.
I saw it in the theater. Kenny and I planned on doing The Ninth Gate about 3 years ago, and that didn't happen. So we watched it again, obviously, before this episode. I am very excited to hear what you think about this movie, because I don't know if you're going to defend this film or not.
I've been what are they going to say? Like, what is this conversation going to be? Yeah. Like, it could go
many
different directions. Yeah. And sure. I have no idea. I have no idea which one it's going to take.
It's kind of like the movie itself, quite frankly. Like, I say that in the sense that, like, you know, I texted Kenny, I don't know, two-thirds of the way through this, and I was just like, this movie's interminable. Like, it's unbelievably feels very long.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really going to ride for much about mm-hmm. this movie, but what I am thoroughly interested to hear from both of you is whether or not we think that this film is, that this tone is intentional.
Right.
Is this a movie that is going out of its way to some sort of a meta commentary, like mm-hmm. Polanski kind of crawling inside the Rosemary's Baby, you know, thing mm-hmm. and trying to kind of deconstruct it in a kind of humorous metatextual way?
Mm-hmm.
Or did this movie just get away from him? The score is jaunty.
It's so jaunty. This movie is a situational comedy. This movie is somehow, and maybe this is a just having done the Planet Hollywood screen drops bias, but this is the Hudson Hawk of fucking satanic occult mysteries. It is.
Yeah.
Like this feels so like, I should have watched a trailer for this before talking, because like now I'm like, God, how was this movie pitched to us? Because I remember it coming out and good being question. Like, it was a thriller from Johnny Depp. And like, I didn't have any thought about Roman Polanski, who was 14 at the time, but it was just like,
he had a thought about you.
There it is.
Yeah. No shit. but it was just like, I remember I only watched it for the first time like last year. It was fairly recent. And so when I was watching this again, I was like, oh, I hope there's an alternative where I can get this for free somewhere. Like, I really didn't want to rent it again. Thank you, IMDb TV with ads. Yeah. And that was how I watched it.
Yeah. I got mine on Tubi.
Yeah.
Tubi! I think it's
on both of them, but
I love Tubi. I have a disaster movie podcast. We love Tubi. So.
Yeah, I know. You guys must be hitting Tubi a lot.
We hit Tubi hard.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was going to say I like this movie. I don't like this movie. I hate this movie. When you said, did it get away from him? I think it got away from him.
Yeah.
I think that's what happened, because
like he was in the edit and he was like, what the fuck do I do with this? Like,
what did I shoot?
Yeah.
And maybe we can, maybe there's a way to salvage this as a straight thriller. Because there's too much farce in this movie to have not had some intention of being like a satanic spoof almost.
Right. A spoof. It feels like a spoof.
When your man Frank Langella walks into the satanic routine and goes, mumbo jumbo, and then kills Lena
Olin.
And
then says mumbo jumbo a dozen more times.
Yeah, he says
mumbo
so many times.
Jumbo.
And it gets everybody to stop. Like, Frank Langella saying mumbo jumbo just gets everybody to be like, uh-oh.
What?
Like, it's not like there's no commotion. There's no what's going on here. Everyone's just like, oh, well, mumbo jumbo. Like, I guess we better pause the proceedings.
I couldn't help but think about, you know, the whole, like, the meme of, like, understanding the assignment.
Right.
And I was like, did Frank Langella understand the assignment? Did Johnny Depp understand this? Was there an assignment? Like, you can't help but
an assignment?
What is this?
Did everybody get a sealed envelope with a different assignment?
That's
and nobody fun. Was allowed to tell everybody else their
that's
assignment.
Fun.
Because that's a good way to make a movie.
That is... I like certain movies that are happening in this movie. I like the movie Lena Olin's in. Lena Olin's doing a great job.
Sure.
I like the movie Frank Langella's in.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp is wandering through all of them like it's the movie Stay Tuned, and he's just clicking the channel and he's ending up in different fucking scenarios.
Yes.
The silent, the girl, like I think she's only credited as the girl, probably supernatural bodyguard. It's like, I don't know what she's doing, but I don't know if she's told to do anything else. Like, go girl, give us nothing. Like, I don't, like, what I get, like, strong, silent female, like, battle-hardened archetype. Like, I'm in for that. But it's just, like, everybody besides like Lena, Olin, and Frank Langella are extra enough to where like I feel like they're going in for it. Besides, mm-hmm. everything else is like too much in a middle register for me to be like if this movie had gone for broke, I could. Right. You know, but for the Roman Polanski of it and the Johnny Depp of it, be like, you know what? There's value here. But this one, I'm just like, I remember watching The Tourist with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie. Sure. Angelina Jolie, who's my number one of ever. I absolutely fucking love her. And I was like, this is the most boring goddamn movie I've ever
it's
seen.
It's so boring.
Like, The Tourist is the most unbelievably, aimlessly boring thing I can remember experiencing in a movie theater. And then watching this, I was like, did Johnny Depp make two The Tourists in his life? Like, what is this?
Well, The Tourist...
What are we sleepwalking
through? What I do kind of love about The Tourist is that he gained a whole bunch of weight before shooting it because he thought that the character would be fat. And then, then he shows up on set and they were like, what the fuck? And then they spent like millions of dollars CG making him thinner.
Oh, really?
Okay, I was going to say, because I remember him being slim in that movie.
That's hysterical. They
CG'd his weight off.
Wow. He obviously thought the character in this movie should be unbelievably boring. he is such a cipher. There is nothing going on within the context of this person's mind.
Uh-huh.
And it's a real almost control for what a movie is like with a protagonist who has no internal monologue and who has no drive.
Yeah.
Who has and also, you know, nothing about this guy. You have absolutely no
You're right.
interest
he
in this guy's
survival.
He only
exists in the timeline of this movie. Yeah. He has no before or afterlife.
Yeah.
And he only exists on top of that. He only exists to kind of like, you know, it's not even like he's putting this movie on his back. It's like he's wheeling it along. It's like he's kind of like, he's in the airport. He's kind of wheeling this movie along, going from place to place, figuring out like literally the most boring fucking mystery of all time.
Uh-huh.
Like childish shit.
Yes.
Now,
it's
like,
crazy how a mystery that ends with presumably accessing the gate
devil.
To hell.
Yeah.
Is so like him walking into the infinite light at the end, you're just like, huh.
Oh.
Like, and he's just like, the fact that they have him go back to a location he was just at, it's like, he left and came back. You had this movie end with a man leaving somewhere and coming back. Like, was the woman fucking him in the grass while the building burned behind him? Was that part of the ritual or was that just for fun?
And like, then the Deus Ex Machina of the piece of paper that just happens to fall off of the top of this bookshelf so that he can, you know, piece together the final piece of this mystery, if you will.
I'm mostly worried about the brothers. I want to know where the twin old
the
men
brothers
are
the best.
They're the best.
Well, that's another example of like, those guys only exist. They only could exist in a great movie. Except this one. Like, you don't come up with old, like, I guess they were
twins.
Portuguese, or were they Italian? I couldn't
twin
figure
Spaniards,
it out.
Spaniards, I think, because they were in Lisbon. So they were, it was Portugal. It was Portugal.
Two old twin Portuguese guys who have a pretty basic understanding of how Lucifer would sign his name in an engraving, that he would use Roman letters and just go ahead and write
else. Clearly a shared mind. Who are clearly one human.
Was it one guy or two? Did you guys check it out?
It's
was
one
it actual
actor.
Twins?
It was
and
one actor.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw the credits and I was like, who are those? Oh, that
but
one
that's
guy.
Adorable.
Okay.
But it feels like you stepped into a Terry Gilliam movie for about 10 minutes in that scene. And you're just like, well, this is a movie that I would have been interested in watching.
Has anybody made a good movie like the movie we are thinking he was trying to make?
I'm going to pause at something here. Because I'm very curious as to whether or not Jordan agrees. I watched Personal Shopper for the first time last weekend, which
sublime
is a masterpiece.
Is the
if
word
you have, it's,
sublime?
It's perfect and it's wonderful and everyone should watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel like tonally, on some level, there is sort of... It's like Roman Polanski was trying to make Personal Shopper and just failed miserably. Like he's trying to kind of do... a ghost story that's sort, you know, like they have sort
of
similarities.
It is kind of a ghost story. I mean, and the fact, but the fact that, because it is, it isn't like, it's not just supernatural at the end. We have Silent Woman who like with the glowing green eyes and she clearly like lightly flies. And we just like, he never seems to notice that. Like he knows she's odd, but we never address the fact that she can fly.
He doesn't address any of this stuff.
No.
I guess the reason that I'm sort of putting it next to Personal Shopper is that there is a similarity in the sense of the journey itself is somewhat similar in a supernatural journey with a grounded person for the most part who is sort of pulled through a supernatural thing. The difference, of course, there's many, many differences, but like the mood and the tone of this movie is all over the fucking place. Whereas Personal Shopper is obviously like very locked into what it's doing and it understands what it's doing.
Yeah.
But like it really comes down to the, so the Johnny Depp thing, I think, is worth sort of unpacking for a second here, because Johnny Depp has, does he have three movies in 99 or just two?
Oh, I think he might have three. Yeah, he must have been prolific at that time.
Because he obviously has Sleepy Hollow, which comes out in November of this year. And that's obviously a big movie for him. But I kind of feel like this is him sort of sleepwalking through this movie in a way that
absolutely.
I don't completely understand why. Yeah, of course, he has Astronaut's Wife as well, Kenny, which we have talked about.
Horrible movie.
Horrible movie too. So he's got like Ninth Gate in March. He's got Astronaut's Wife in August, and he's got Sleepy Hollow in November. Sleepy Hollow kind of opens the doors for him because it's a big fat hit.
I give Johnny Depp the actor a little more credit than sleepwalking. I think this was a decision. My sense was that he made a choice to play this understated.
I think so too. I think he made a commitment to droll. You know what? I'm going to be the foil for whatever, like, because this is shenanigans. Like, I'm going to be the foil for shenanigans. But, like, Roman Polanski is making a movie about shenanigans that, like, how committed are we to the shenanigans? Like, because this movie, to me, the thing that I kept thinking about that this movie made me most remember, because it feels like a noir. Like, it feels like its core is trying to be a noir. Yep. This movie, to me, is if Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid wasn't funny. Do you guys ever see Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid?
Yeah. The Steve Martin movie.
One of my absolute fucking favorite Martin movies. It is an assemblage of footage of classic films with Steve Martin playing the only like concurrent live action or one of the only concurrent live action people, like linearly. And he plays, Marlowe.
So funny.
Plays Detective Marlowe, and he gets like cutting, like he'll be filmed in a train car, and then on the other side of him, it's fucking Veronica Lake. Joan Crawford.
I had no idea that's
movie.
What that movie was about.
Yes,
that's brilliant.
Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid is a Frankenstein of classic films, and Steve Martin playing the hard boiled detective solving the mystery through scenes with various classic films stitched in. That was this movie to me. If you didn't have as good of an idea as Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, like what if we just stitched together all of these movies with a dry noir protagonist and then like, but we didn't really feel passionate about it. So we just kind of copped out partway through.
Well, it also like, so just because it's worth noting kind of where we are in Polanski's career, you know, he kind of obviously does Chinatown in 74, does the Tenant, Tess, Pirates, Frantic, Bitter Moon, Death and the Maiden, this movie, The Pianist. So like,
wow,
look, it's a weird run.
Yeah.
These are like Polanski, The Worst and a Monster. These are really, really fucking good movies.
Some of them are good. Death and the Maiden is an incredible
Well, the fact this comes right before The Pianist, it's like, wow, you pivoted back. Like this feels like one of those
three
things where there wouldn't come. This feels like one of those movies where there wouldn't be an after. You would just be now he makes straight to video on demand kind of shit.
Well, but I know this is going to sound glib, but like there never should have been an after, obviously, right? Like he should have been in jail. So
he was a fully fucking convicted. Like it's
he was. I mean,
he fled because he was going to be put in prison, not because I don't want to get charged. Like
no.
Oh my god.
And we could spend as much time as we want on this or as little, but it certainly, when you talk about Polanski, you kind of have to like, and the fact that he was still kind of able to make these movies that were still put out by major American studios
is so
a real
shocking.
Mind fuck. Uh-huh. Right. Like, so I think he is convicted of rape. I think that happened around, I just want to like kind of throw it out. It was like around 77. I think
it's around 77. I'm looking it up right now, but
basically his trajectory
is 77.
A bunch of Polish films.
Yep.
Rosemary's Baby. Robert Evans brings him over for Rosemary's Baby. Yep. I think he does a couple other things. Chinatown, you know.
Chinatown,
and then Chinatown, you know, in a lot of ways.
When's Revulsion?
Repulsion.
That's 65. Repulsion okay, is that's like his second
Repulsion,
movie.
Repulsion. Yeah.
So he makes Chinatown, and then Sharon Tate is killed right around then. While he is in, I believe, a different country shooting something else. I think he's in France when it happens. Or
somewhere. Yeah.
And then
she's killed in 69. Yeah.
She's killed in 69?
Oh yeah, because summer of 69, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Sorry. She's killed in 69. He rapes the girl in 76. Yeah. And then in 77, what happened, or apparently what happened, was he was under the impression he was going to get a very short prison sentence.
Yes.
Like time served, like 42 days, and the judge was going to give him 50 years. So then he...
Well, she's a little girl, so...
Then he... I know. Then he flees.
Like, there was a calculus for him there where he was like, worth it. Like, you know.
Sort of.
A million percent.
And then it was like, oh, no, I got to run. Like, it was going to be okay. And I would have had like an outlaw status thing, and it's fine. Yeah. And I can do it again, and I'll get 50 more days. But then he was like, oh, God, this is serious. I better go.
Yeah. Well, I thought something else out there, which is like what his defenders would say for years and years and years until it turned, was Roman Polanski, and this is kind of nasty what I'm about to say, but Roman Polanski always played up the idea, or always played up the fact that his family was like super affected by the Holocaust.
Yeah.
He had sibling and parents who died in the Holocaust. And then Sharon Tate's murder. So the idea is he's a really messed up, fucked up guy to begin with.
He gets a pass now, because these horrible things happen to him.
Yes. Absolutely. Now, subsequently, not that one rape you should be, you know, get your time served and call it a day. Subsequently, many other women have come out, including women as young as 10.
Yeah.
Said that he also raped them.
Yeah.
So then, I mean, the fact
there's
that
never
that all came out.
One. There's never just
You don't go in for one 13-year-old.
You don't. It's a lifestyle. It's a habit. So no.
So then, in like, once all this comes out, once it becomes like there's really no way for you to deny this or explain it away, this, how in the 80s and 90s and then up to the 2000s he gets to make movies, let alone win Best Director, is lunacy.
Well, I think this does get back to the general's daughter of it, because like when you consider the gallingness of the general's daughter, like how does this movie exist? This is so gross. This is so creepy. It's like, guys, this movie came out in a world where Roman Polanski had a movie come out in the same year, and he wasn't even done yet putting out movies in the States. And we were like,
and he was going
to
win an Oscar
and
in
we
3 years.
We weren't even having the conversation. There was nothing even close to the conversation.
Jordan, he is 88 and put out a movie 3 years ago.
Yeah. I remember. Because, you know, I remember because Adele Hanel stormed out of the César Awards.
Yeah,
clapping.
One person.
And shouting, viva la pedofilie, viva la pedofilie. And being
I think three actresses left the César Awards.
And she wasn't hailed as a national hero for that.
I'm
that
kind
was
of
a
amazed that he.
Controversial move.
Yeah. I'm also kind of amazed. Like, we don't talk about Carnage as a movie because it
kind of
doesn't
exist. Oh my
God,
you're right.
But like, we got Jodie Foster, Kate Winslet, Christoph Waltz, John C. Reilly all signed on to make a movie with this guy.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Like, and these are people, I mean, Jodie Foster, obviously renowned, willing to turn a blind eye to bad people, it seems.
Right. Renowned.
But,
yeah.
But Kate Winslet, I thought would be
famously
above this, but she also,
the art
I
from
guess,
the artist.
You know, did a Woody Allen film shortly thereafter.
I you don't want to get too caught up in these weeds, but like, they're no better than anybody else. Like, I mean,
sure.
Like, who famously turned down a Woody Allen movie or turned down a Roman Polanski
movie? Until 2018. Yeah.
Nobody. I have never heard a story before 2018 or 2019 of someone saying, I will not work with this person because he is a rapist. Or I will not work with this person because he is a racist. I will not work. I've never, maybe with Mel Gibson a little bit, but like.
Yeah, for like 15 minutes.
But then like Andrew fucking Garfield's making a movie that again gets nominated for Best Director, Best Picture.
Yep.
So like everyone
and Texas is Gilead and America Hates Women. So like it's all just of a piece, which is just like, it's just phenomenal to look at it and be like, let's just acknowledge for a minute, you guys, because it's like, oh, that's so fucked up when you look at it like that.
I know. I almost look at it more. I really like, again, not trying to like say I'm better than any of these people. I think like the lesson of humanity is, you know, like what Steve Zahn said in White Lotus, like nobody sees their privilege. And I really, truly yes. believe that. I think most people are fucking garbage when they get when they get to a certain level.
But I think it's worth it.
Just to finish the point, just sociologically, just the, what we've allowed to have happen in this country, in this culture, in this world,
yeah.
It's truly like deeply troubling.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, when anything can become normal.
Yeah.
Anything can become normal. And then once it becomes normal, undoing it, it has to be a devoted, constant, relentless practice of undoing to break a habit, to break a pattern. And everything became normal.
They also, the major sort of piece of all of this to some degree is they have to start making bad movies.
Yes,
if they start making bad
movies,
it's really easy to jump on board and be like, fuck them. Because now they're not making anything that we care about. And to both of your points, this should have been the beginning of Roman Polanski makes bad movies. We're done with him. But he pivots to your point and he makes the Pianist, mm-hmm. Arguably maybe one of his most personal movies. And wins the best director puts wind back in his sails. This should have been the beginning of the end. And unfortunately, he makes The Pianist. But I do kind of want to
they always called The Pianist.
The Pianist.
I remember they're very specific about calling it The Pianist.
Because they didn't like that it sounded like pianist.
It sounded like penis. It didn't sound like pianist.
You know what I mean. So I'm going to give a brief synopsis of this film. Dean Corso, played by Johnny Depp, specializes in tracking down rare and exotic volumes for collectors. Boris Balkan, played by Frank Langella, has recently acquired a 17th Good century name. Satanic text called The Nine Gates, a legendary book written by Satan himself. With the nine gates in his possession, Corso soon finds himself at the center of a strange and violent going-ons. Not only is his apartment ransacked, it appears that he is being shadowed ferociously by others determined to regain the book. The ninth gate opened on December 24th, 1999 in Los Angeles and New York, and then it opened wider.
Wow, a Christmas release.
A Christmas release. It opened wider.
I like that. I'm into that.
On March 10th, 2000. It would go on to make $58 million on a $38 million budget. So this movie made money. Mm-hmm. $58 million in 99 is probably close to $100 million today.
Yeah.
It's got 43% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 57% from audiences. I'm going to read two brief clips of Ebert's two-star review said Roman Polanski's The Ninth Gate, a satanic thriller, opens with a spectacularly good title sequence. I don't agree. And goes downhill from
so
there.
It's so bad. That title sequence is so long. And there are it keeps going through gates way more than nine.
Way more than nine gates in that
title sequence.
It's also just like that title sequence, which is a good 3 minutes, maybe 5 minutes long.
Yeah.
In a movie that already feels...
It's a good 3 to 5 minutes of Twitter scrolling for me.
It's just like what is this?
Before we were really nailing it with 3D animation, it thought it was nailing it with 3D animation.
The movie does a good job of mirroring its deaths with situations from the tarot deck and making the Telfer widow, played by Lena Olin, more sinister by, I think, inserting electronic undertones beneath her speech. I also like the atmosphere evoked by the dialogue, which isn't too dumbed down, uses some of the jargon of the book trade, and allows for us to follow Corso's process of deduction as he figures out what the engravings mean and what Bolton's true motives are. It's just that the film is a film of such big themes should be about more than the fate of a few people. While at the end, I didn't yearn for spectacular special effects, I did wish for spectacular information. Something awesome, not just a fade to white.
I also think that's definitely Lena Olin's voice.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, Lena Olin always sounds... That's one of the coolest things about Lena Olin is that she sounds like that.
I totally agree. The AV Club, however, says, Polanski, however, knows this well and wisely refuses to let the film take itself too seriously while just as wisely avoiding self-parody. For all its unabashed trashiness, The Ninth Gate remains an expertly crafted, eerily effective bit of satanic noir from its start to somewhere just before its finish, helped by at every turn by Johnny Depp, who seems even more aware of Gates' inherent absurdity than Polanski himself.
How it embarrassing may be for that person. What
correct. What it may be the sort of film enjoyed
published against, on the internet.
It may be the sort of film enjoyed against your better judgment, but The Ninth Gate is hard not to enjoy anyway. What the fuck movie did they
I don't watch? Know how you can I don't know how you can praise it like that and say that the star did that the director didn't understand what they were making, but thank God the star did. Like,
but thank God Johnny Depp was there to save this movie.
Yeah, it's like, well, it seems like the guy leading it in front of the camera had a much better grasp of what was going on than the director, but this is a hit. Like,
but I will just say, for what it's worth, Johnny Depp does have a history, for all intents and purposes, of quote unquote understanding the assignment, right?
Of course. And like, that was how he
notoriously epic Pirates of the Caribbean is what it is, because Johnny Depp shows up and is like, this is the movie. And yeah, they got lucky that he did that.
I mean, Benny and June works because of how he plays that. Like, that's him. That's
or Edward Scissorhands.
Impossibly beautiful man who can actually convince you that he can play Kirk.
Right. And we were even talking at the beginning, before we even got on mic, we were talking about Nightmare on Elm Street, because we're doing that on the Patreon. Nightmare on Elm Street, he kind of understands the assignment early on, right? Like, he's one of the, you know, that's his first movie, ultimately. Yeah. And it's like, he just locks into a thing. Now, sometimes it doesn't work, right? We're looking at it here, Mordecai's and other, like, there's lots of examples of movies where he just locks into a thing and they're just like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But this, I think, is just a boring performance. Like, whether or not he's conscious of what he's doing, and I would agree with Kenny that I do think that Johnny Depp has chosen the thing.
I think he's made a choice. I don't think he's made the choice to exist in a world that is this farcical.
Correct.
I you know, the funny thing is, a movie I keep coming back to that I do think is farcical and extremely effective in its farce is Eyes Wide Shut. And it reminds like, in terms of a movie that is able to kind of at once be thrilling and be scary, be emotionally resonant, but also be like over the top ridiculous at times in a way that like, so if you're in the right mood to watch Eyes Wide Shut and have fun with it, there's fun to be had. If you're in the right mood to a lot of fun to be had throughout the entire film, right? Mm-hmm. If you're in the mood to have fun with this one, like you get the scene with the twins. You get Franklin Jell's performance, you get Lena Olin's performance, and you get, I think, the sex scene outside the burning, you know, cathedral.
The woman in the wheelchair.
That's fun. Yes, when she gets rolled into the burning room.
That actually, the two best scenes in this movie involve fire, and it is when the wheelchair just barrels through doors and knocks open into a fire. Yeah. And she just catches fire. That's amazing. Yeah. And when Frank Langella realizes that the endorphins of him thinking he's invincible have worn off and he is in fact just on fire.
That is
amazing stuff. The whole Frank Langella catching on fire thing.
Great.
And he's
scene.
Like, I can't be burned. I'm not feeling heat. And Johnny Depp's like, great, give us another one. And he just pours gas on himself. Was like, this is great. I like this movie. And that's why, like, if the dials had just been higher in the farce, I think it actually would have jibed for me.
That's why your Hudson Hawk analogy was such a good one.
Yes.
Because, like, it could have been just like, again,
that movie is
just
committed to the bit.
Yes.
It's so silly.
Yes.
But, if it was all Frank Langella burning himself alive, well, that's great stuff.
Well, I think I also,
Hudson Hawk is about a man who wants a cup of coffee. It's a man who wants a fucking cappuccino.
Who doesn't?
But I also think
Hudson Hawk with him sipping a cappuccino
is
about as climactic as Johnny Depp walking into a palace of light.
Phil, when you say like you're, you know, when one of your bumps was the piece of paper floating down, that's a bump because this movie takes itself a little too seriously.
Yes,
but if it was a sillier movie, that's exactly the kind of Deus Ex Machina that would feel like hilarious.
That would have worked in Hudson
But it's
Hawk.
Also like, you guys are speaking of two paths that I think are really interesting. Because I think
it also would have worked in Eyes Wide Shut, by the way.
The Eyes Wide Shut, the level of difficulty that Eyes Wide Shut is playing at why I think it's a fucking masterpiece.
Right.
And it's what, and perhaps this movie was trying to achieve that. But, you know, there are a lot of similarities. I mean, there are similarities between, you know, Tom Cruise's character in Eyes Wide Shut and Johnny Depp's character in this movie. Like, it's episodic. It's a journey. There's a lot of sort of, there's the hint of the supernatural, although this goes farther than that. But, but I agree with both of you that, like, there's a lack of commitment
It's
or
that,
a lack
and
of
that's
understanding
where you're gonna lose me, is a lack
of
commitment
of what it wants to be doing, that you're just kind of like, it's, we've talked about this many, many times on this podcast, and Jordan, I think you'll be on board with this too, which is, you know, an understanding of intent and of a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And as a viewer, you have to feel like the filmmaker's committed to something. They have a vision for this thing. And if you feel that confidence, you'll go along for the ride.
This, right, like, okay, where are you going to drag me along to? Right. What are you going to do here?
This, I'm so checked out because I don't feel like he's committed to it and really knows what he wants to be doing with it. It also, the pacing is fucking languid. Like, it's a really brutally paced movie.
Yeah. I don't mind a long movie, but like when I like clicked on that, like remembering how I felt about it the first time, then seeing that 134 minutes, I was like, ooh.
Right.
It's a big 134 right there.
And then you
like,
also think about
3 hours of Suspiria from 2018 did not feel that long to me.
I've still never seen that movie because I'm a big baby. But I do think that, and I get scared of things, but I look at like Johnny Depp performances like Secret Window, Nick of Time, The Tourist. Like there is this weird little like lane of just sort of...
When he plays it straight, it's very boring.
Right?
Yeah. It's like he really does have two... It's like he has two speeds. It's full speed and at park.
Yeah.
But
you know, he plays it straight in Donnie Brasco and he's amazing. So there's there's certainly, it's almost, I mean, like he can do it. Yeah. He's just not the guy to go to.
Well, and I think another parallel for my mind, in my mind, when I watch this movie is like Clue. Like the movie Clue has like more suspense in it, actually. Yes. Like I feel a sense of tension mm-hmm. when I'm watching Clue, and it's a fucking comedy. It is a farce. Mm-hmm. But like mm-hmm. when the singing telegram girl shows up in the doorway and she's lit only backlit and she's just in shadow, you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen to the singing telegram girl? And right. when they're like running around the house, you feel a sense of like bated breath of like, what
there's
are they
no
going to discover next?
Yeah,
and there's more suspense in Clue than there is in a movie about one man learning to harness the power wholly of Satan and determine his material destiny on Earth. Erase me from the book of life and write me in the black book of death. Like, okay, that should be more fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I want to live deliciously in this, so fucking give it to me.
Before you just, you know, gave me the log line, I didn't know what the log line was.
Yeah.
And I feel like the movie didn't know what the logline was because, totally. You know, the movie's not about Johnny Depp. The movie is about Frank Langella. Like, that's, I would rather see, now again, there's no reason to rewrite this movie, but you would rather, you'd rather see the man, the lunatic devil man's pursuit of being erased from the book of life.
Yeah, those scenes where people are just getting killed for their book, like old people are getting murdered for their books.
For their books.
Like that sounds like a crazy ass movie that I want to watch unfold.
Yeah.
But we watch all the parts. Like it's like we don't see the crimes. We just see the crime solving. And guys, police work is boring. Like the majority of police work is boring. That's why shows
boring
have to make
this.
It sensational.
Yeah.
And we're watching the police work here.
The other movie that I thought of as I was watching this the other day, Kenny, is also another 99 movie, 8mm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
8mm is got a lot and it's problematic in its own ways.
It's grisly.
It's grisly and it's crazy and it's what have you. But again, committed to a bit, right? Like Schumacher was a guy who was like, if nothing else, I'm in 110% on this thing that I've decided.
They should have
switched
movies.
And so is Nick Cage. Well, and I was absolutely, when you guys were thinking about the idea of like a character, an actor who goes sort of all in and we know these, I was thinking of Nick Cage as a parallel this entire time. And honestly, if you put Nick Cage in this movie as Dean
Corso,
way more
interesting.
This movie works. This movie
million
actually
times
works.
Better.
Million
and just should, with his, just be like, hey, Nick, pick a lane. And whatever he would do would be at least an intense enough frequency to make this movie like, bring it together. Be the rug that really ties the room together.
What were you going to say?
I think they should have switched movies because I think Joel Schumacher would have sillied this movie up.
And this movie with bisexual lighting a la Joel Schumacher would have been fucking amazing.
Well, that's a big deal about this, which is basically like this movie should have been High Camp. Right?
Yes.
And
like that's where this movie would have like sang a little bit. Whereas all eight Joel Schumacher is such a weird filmmaker to me, because when he goes for it, he's a lot of fun.
Batman and Robin, movie, baby!
One of the worst movies ever. Sure. So much fun. Well, it's
and
a really
nobody
fun.
Nobody gets to tell me that Uma Thurman didn't know.
Oh,
what
Uma
she
Thurman
was doing.
understood the
that
assignment.
Poison Ivy performance is fucking it's tremendous.
It's great.
By the way, so did Arnold Schwarzenegger. But
yes, he did.
Like that. If the only thing that's bad about that movie in real life is that it's a Batman movie and it's part of like a and it's part of a thing.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, because people, you know, put these like unnecessary expectations on it. But whatever. That movie would have killed it in 2021 when you're allowed to fuck around a little more.
Yeah.
But so sometimes it really feels like Schumacher is trying to pull back or trying to do something different or trying to not be himself in a way. And I think both of his 99 movies are that. Flawless doesn't go far enough. And 8mm. Honestly, that movie should be fucking serious. It's about snuff films. Like,
yeah.
I don't think you want crazy ass shit. Like, which it is. There's some really like
crazy,
honestly, wild stuff in there.
No,
but it's like Polanski does it.
I have a policy about the Saw movies that they can get away with anything besides sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And because once you've committed to going that far with out and out gore violence, there has to be something that's off the table where you're like, yeah, but this is just for fun. It's just a cartoon. And when you bring sexual violence into something like that, it makes it really serious in a way that the bigness and the hyperbolicness of the violence and the deaths is like, you're not taking sexual violence seriously anymore. Actually.
No, I agree.
You're making a bit of it, which is why the only Saw I actually have a problem with is number 6, because there's a rape dungeon that somebody is like punished for. It's best if you binge them, really. Like, it's like a sci-fi miniseries in the 90s.
Is it?
They really hold up that way.
I don't think you'd be scared.
It's why number no, yeah. it goes such beyond the point of absurdity. I think it's 4 or 5 that becomes like a woman punishing like predatory insurance people for scamming customers.
I mean, that's
like,
cool. That's
yeah, like it becomes an allegory. But like,
and you're a Wan boy.
Yeah, and I
am a Wan boy. I like James Wan.
And I know. We could have a different conversation on a different podcast. About that with me.
You're a Wan man.
A Wan man.
I don't know if I'm a Wan man, but I did like Aquaman, and I did like Furious 7.
But you know, and my one gripe with Aquaman should have been a musical. Aquaman should have got
interesting.
A Let Orm sing. Let Patrick Wilson give
you
me
might
an
get
aria
that in the second one. You
on
don't
a
know.
Submarine right. in a storm yeah. while he's fighting yeah. his brother. Like this, is the old let give me well. Jason Momoa. No advanced vocal production. Just give me the raw Jason Momoa ballad. All I need to say with all of that is that you hit a certain like you said, you gotta play 8mm straight. It's about fucking snuff films.
You gotta
man.
Play.
Like,
I agree.
There's enough going on there because it's about sexual violence. There's nothing going on in the ninth gate.
Nothing.
So you
nothing.
Need to hit the gas.
But I
and
also
then you need
think
to
that
light a match.
But you're also great talking point. About like interpretation of script as well, right? Like I don't think Andrew Kevin Walker was. I think he was writing. Like a gnarly, dark movie about snuff films and was like really going there.
Yeah.
And I think that Schumacher was like, yeah, I can do that. And it's just not in his tool belt. But all that being said, I do think.
Well.
But I
know. I think like he had an interpretation.
He did.
It just wasn't right. But you know, we had Jim on, and
we had a great episode on 8mm. It was like, I think it's a fascinating movie, and
it's,
I think it's
worth digging into.
100%. It's a fascinating movie.
I want to talk for a quick second about the tone that I think Polanski was aiming for, and I think Eyes Wide Shut is an interesting touch point because there's a moment in Eyes Wide Shut where it's at the orgy. And all the women are in masks and the men are in these cloaks and they're slow dancing to Strangers in the Night. And it is a clearly winky, funny moment where Kubrick is like, do you see what I'm doing here? I'm making a very weird kind of dark comedy. I think that was what Polanski was aiming for with this. But like, that is a narrow, narrow target. And it's a specific thing. And you know, that mixed with, I would argue, the miscasting of the female lead, who, and I don't want to throw her under the bus, to your point, she might have been poorly directed, but like her delivery is insane.
She's Polanski's wife.
Yeah. Well.
Oh, is she?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, okay.
So there's that. But I do think that this movie,
I mean, at that point it almost becomes avant-garde. Like she almost, yeah, like Snake Eats the Tail for me is so one-dimensional that, yeah, like, did I like go through Interstellar and the fifth dimension is love and now I'm there? Like what is reality? This, yeah.
I did not hate her performance.
I was in for it. I just, yeah, like, I didn't.
Okay.
I thought it was doing exactly what it was supposed to do, yeah, but I didn't know what she thought she was supposed to do.
Well, I don't.
Okay.
And furthermore, I don't really know what purpose she served in this story outside of being, you know,
yeah, she's like, was she murdering people?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Or was she? Now I want to take something to her. Is she the one killing the old people, or is she just taking him after to get the book? I'm unclear.
No fucking clue. That's
no
the
idea.
Point.
No. Okay.
Who do you? Gotcha. Yeah. No fucking clue. No idea. And but it's not her fault that she had no fucking clue. I also kind of like that she's obviously some, you know, devil woman. But
yeah,
just rocks the messy bun or the messy pony.
The absolute, like, I at about three quarters of the way through the movie, I was like, that there, this woman has had no hair and makeup. She must have showed up in her fucking clothes. Like that, yep, messy bun isn't even like, that's like an actual messy, yeah, bun. Like one, like a human that woman wakes up with. And it's like, whoa, it's the first thing in the morning. There's nothing Hollywood about that messy bun. I was like, this is straight up unwashed hair put up in the worst way. Like her hair is stringy and not clean. It was like, what wild, is this messy wild bun choice?
And the craziest, the bravest choice of this movie was to go with that messy bun because the continuity must, yeah, be
fucked,
out of control.
It's fucked.
It was getting all those hairs in the exact same, yeah, I think they
it
did it.
So
I think they
consistent
nailed it.
No, it, yeah, was, I think so, they nailed it. I think I did at a certain point, like she takes her hair down at one point and puts it back up and then it looks exactly the same as before. I was like, wow, it is exactly the same messy, yeah, bun that it was before.
The work
this
of the devil right there.
That is some supernatural shit. And just like her pants that like fit but are kind of too short and the trainers that she's wearing, I was just like, what the fuck is this whole deal?
Great,
like,
jacket, that's a great 99 jacket, like I,
you guys 99 have,
here's,
jacket.
I done, here's what I done, you have
I done
done.
Her shit.
You have successfully turned me around on the girl's performance because I'm actually sort of like, you know what, there is a choice there, and it's at least it is befuddling in a somewhat compelling way, unlike kind of anything else in this movie.
And right, at least, right, she's a cipher as a supernatural character. Like, yeah, Johnny, yeah, Depp's character as a cipher is like, no, you're a human man. Like, why don't I understand anything
I don't give
about
a shit,
you?
Yeah.
At least with her, it's like, well, you're not human, and maybe you're not even real. And like, so at least does anybody else, yeah, see you when you're in a room with this guy, or does like, or are you fucking, are you Tyler Durden? Like, what, yeah, what are, yeah,
you? Wardy. Can I? So I want to point out one other thing, another missed opportunity in this movie, which is this film is shot by Darius Condrey, which is one of our best cinematographers in the world. City of Lost Children, Seven. Recently, he did Uncut Gems. I mean, a phenomenal, wow, cinematographer. This movie is so flat and colorless. The palette is boring as fuck. The special, yeah, effects are all the green screen shit looks absolutely terrible.
All the green screen driving things,
it's
like
awful.
That at a certain point, it was like, is this becoming the biggest argument for this as a satire? Because, yeah, this is, Like, we've gone beyond parody with these, like, motion, like, images behind us when they're on the motorcycle. It was like, are we, is this, like, bringing up Baby? Like, are
maybe
we this in is the a 1940s?
Good movie. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe this is good.
Like, this is... I will never pass up a chance to remember how huge Frank Langella is. That guy's
a big man.
He's a big man.
You know what? I like him with hair.
He is so intimidating.
That hair
large.
Piece is crazy, though.
I like him with hair. I think he's a good murderer.
He's a good murderer.
God, he's good. God, he's good.
I really, really like the Frank Langella, who only is a high class villain.
Yes.
And then we
mind's eye, real Frank Langella is a high class villain. I don't know what he's getting up to, but like Frank Langella, the man, is a high class villain. That man is a Bond villain in our real world. Elegance, the stature, everything.
And then we fucked it all. The weirdest thing is like, okay, so he fulfills his destiny and plays the, you know, the greatest high class villain of all time, Richard Nixon.
Right.
And gets a Oscar nomination for it. Yeah. And then we decide, let's try him out as a good guy. No.
Yeah, we
come on. Look at this guy. I don't.
He's great in the Americans, though.
Great in the Americans. I was going to say great in the Americans, though. Like that move, that show is so fucking like that's such a weird mind fuck that like he might be playing like. Right, here's the thing about that show. That show is about people who are ostensibly villains, like geopolitical villains.
Mm-hmm. But
they are presented as protagonists, as sympathetic protagonists throughout the series. They're written that way. You are meant
it
to
is one of the most
them.
Deft feats of balancing that
correct.
Reality.
It's impossible.
Right.
Like that. And I have my issues with the Americans as it wore on. But wow, like doing that over the course of a six season show.
I want to read a quote here that I think is worth reading. The film press reported around the time of the North American release of the film that there was creative friction between Johnny Depp and Roman Polanski. Johnny Depp
the
said
AV Club clearly picked up on that.
Depp said it's the director's job to push to provoke things out of an actor. And then Polanski said of Depp, he decided to play it rather flat, which wasn't how I envisioned it.
So Johnny was perhaps craving more direction. And in lieu of more direction, he made a choice. And then Polanski was like, oh, stupid choice. And then they just never talked about it.
Stupid choice.
Yeah.
And then it feels like, so your score is obviously brought in post, right? Obviously, you know, so... The score truly sounds like Curb Your Enthusiasm at times.
Here's the thing that the score reminded me of. Like because I remember before I watched The Last Seduction ever, people talk about The Last
Great
Seduction
movie.
Like an erotic thriller, but they talk about it like an erotic thriller and it's not.
Yeah.
It's actually,
I mean, there is a fair amount of sex in it.
There, it's erotic. I mean, you can't escape the eroticism of Linda Fiorentino in the 90s. You just, like, if she was standing in front of
radiate
you, it would
sex.
Be like, I'm in an erotic thriller right now.
Yeah.
And nothing was happening.
I know. Men in Black was an erotic thriller.
Honestly.
But Dogma.
Like, I remember the first time I remember watching that, I was like, this is a goofy comedy. Like, she's fucking with this guy the entire time. The music.
True.
The music the entire time is almost jaunty. That is not the music or ambiance of an erotic thriller. It's more like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels than
That's
it
what
is.
The score
basic
is it's
instinct.
Bizarre.
And that is what is happening. And while I was watching this, I was like, this is making me feel like the time, like The Last Seduction, a really good movie that I watched, and I was like, oh, everything everybody told me this movie was, like, it's erotic, but everything else is not true. We just put it in the erotic thriller camp because it's Linda Fiorentino in the 90s. But the score, the atmosphere, the intention here, the way she is dicking this guy around and making fun of him the entire movie, nothing about this. Like, this is a caper comedy. And The Ninth Gate feels like a caper comedy in large part thanks to the decisions of the score.
Well, because this is the thing, and Kenny and I, we've talked about this on many other episodes too, but like, you as an audience member don't know, quote unquote, how to feel until a score comes in. The score is truly underlining
the
intent of the movie, and that's fine.
Yeah. Sound design and music is what makes horror
I think that if you take that lesson and apply it to this movie, then this movie is a straight up comedy because the score is pretty much comedic for 70 or 80% of it.
It's like, so, is this an Inspector Clouseau experience? Like, what are we, is this like midnight so on the like Ninth Gate Express? Like, where is this music taking me right now?
So that's, it's an interesting point because the score does betray this idea that this is a farcical satire of movies like this. That's not where I would have gone with it. I would have gone so much bigger and more over the top and and more of this absurd gothic stuff. I don't think, just for me at least, I don't think you're making fun of anything with a score like this. I think you are causing some cognitive dissonance with a score.
You are. It's not commenting and it's not subverting. It's just making you go, like, I think I saw something about, I've only watched one episode of White Lotus so far, but I saw a tweet about it. And that, like, in somebody, I saw somebody tweet about it before I had watched any of it that was like, I'm really enjoying White Lotus. I wish I didn't feel like the score was trying to make me feel like something really important was happening all the time.
Did you unfollow them immediately? You're right.
I don't even think I follow them. I think it was just RT'd into my timeline. But then I watched the first episode and just like, and listening to them, I didn't have a problem with music. I was really liking the music. This movie needed White Lotus's music. I was like, oh yeah, I get what that person is saying. Like, I do feel like something, but like, it's supposed to. And in the scope of what's important in the show, something really important is happening. And like,
well, you know, it's so funny that you're
how and what we build tension around. This movie deserved a score, even like the White fucking Lotus had.
Could you imagine if it had that? It would be awesome.
Well, it's funny you say that, Jordan, because I was reading an interview with the composer of White Lotus, and he said that Mike White told him that he wanted the score to feel like at any moment some sort of a ritual was going to happen. Some sort of human sacrifice at any moment.
And Jordan, we don't want to give anything away, but like, if this movie should have had that exact same thing. At any moment, there can be a sacrifice to the devil.
Because and it really was. At any moment, it could have happened. The amount of like random fucking deaths and like when the this movie is so confused that it's like when Johnny Depp is running away from the booksellers, the little men the first time, and that scaffolding falls down, it really does feel like the scaffolding was an accident. Not like something's after him. I was like, they couldn't do another take because they couldn't reset up the scaffolding. And so that was it. Like Johnny Depp literally had to run from old scaffolding. That was what that moment felt like. It was like, oh, that was just a construction error. And they had to like play through the pain.
I thought the same thing because I was like, wait, is this supposed to be suspenseful? Is this supposed to be funny? You just don't know how you're supposed to feel basically through this entire film, which by the way, isn't necessarily a bad thing.
I don't mind being
discombobulated by a movie.
I don't even hate this movie. I just wish it was more of everything.
More of everything.
But in the final analysis of this movie, it doesn't come together.
Ultimately, it does not come together.
The thing with the Mike White score, with the White Lotus score, is in the beginning, that's discombobulating as well.
Yes.
That doesn't make sense too. And on top of that, like, in our, you know, current climate where at least I'm hypersensitive to this stuff, it also was a little like, are you putting like tribal music over this? Like,
are you
fucking insane?
Yeah.
And then at the end of this,
what are you doing?
That's how it feels. It's like this, not even like this is a choice. Like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And then at the end, it really fucking comes together. Well, and the whole thing makes perfect sense.
Yeah. What I liked about it, like, because it would not have even occurred to me if I had not seen that tweet to really even, like, I would have just accepted the music as it was coming at me. But like, when they said that, it was like, I wish it didn't make me feel like things were really important. And I was like, but doesn't that the point though? Because if what we're in is like a circus of the mundane with these rich white people, the point is that like, everything is extreme in this context. Like, it's like, no, but this is life and death with the most banal shit you can imagine and the most entitled people possible. Like, the point is the cacophony. The point is the imbalance. And in this one, it doesn't feel like the point is the imbalance. It just feels like somebody had their heart set on that music the entire time and it didn't matter what the movie ended up being. It was like, no, but this is the score I said I would have.
They were like,
all the composers are busy. This is what we've got. Yeah.
That's why I love that. That's what excited me so much about the Matrix trailer.
Yeah,
was just this feeling of not. I mean, the Go Ask Alice is awesome. That's not what I'm talking about. But so just great. This feeling of like, oh, thank God, someone is trying again. Like, just, oh, Thank God. Like, at this point, it doesn't even matter if it's good or bad, because like, I know that I'm going to experience something.
And the thing with the, like, regardless of how anybody feels about Jupiter Ascending or Speed Racer, I was initially cool on Speed Racer, but then I came around to it, but I've always loved Jupiter Ascending. You don't doubt that no matter what the Wachowskis are going to give you, they're going to go all in.
Yeah.
What Resurrections is, it's going all the way the fuck in. There's going to be zero holdback in this movie.
When it's
calling
it's just
Jupiter Ascending a bad movie, misses the point. But, and like, furthermore, like, it's really looking a gift horse in the mouth. I get that, you know, look, it doesn't work, but like, look at what you're
Look at what you're getting here. What the Ninth Gate needed was an Eddie Redmayne and Jupiter Ascending performance. It needed that level of weird, specific crazy.
If this film starred Eddie Redmayne, Oscar is for that. I agree. It's really, you know, it's funny because I feel like, and people have been saying this for a long time about how sort of how way ahead of the game the Wachowskis are and have been for so long.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just rewatched Reloaded and Revolutions, and it's just like,
I need to finally do the revisits.
I remember how both those films were, you know, at the time they were received very poorly. Yeah. Everyone was like, is this?
Yeah.
And then now, I mean, the reclamation is slow,
right?
But I guarantee you that people will go back to those films before Resurrections comes out, and Resurrections is going to tear it all apart all over again. And everyone's going to just be like, but wait a second. So now I got to wait 20 years until I can understand Resurrection.
Yeah. And like, I will fully acquiesce that Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions, it's just too galaxy brain for me. Like, that's the rubberiness of the effects that kind of limited them in certain
ways.
There's
like time.
It's just a product of the time. And like, that's not anybody's fault, but I remember that bugging me at the time. It was like, but you did such a good job in 99 and it looks so cool because you didn't try and do too much. But that was like the biggest thing that bothered me about the Matrix movies, what they just started looking at video games at a certain point. As far as the content of them go, I don't pretend to understand Bjork. I don't pretend to understand
Bjork is my girl.
Movies.
I don't have a negative word to say about Bjork because I
can't get on her level. So I'm like, Bjork, you're over there on the moon and I love that about you. But if someone was like, what do you think about Bjork? I'd be like, I'm not qualified to have a thought about Bjork. I'm not qualified to have an actual thought beyond like, it looked too much like a video game about Revolutions. Matrix.
I get it. That's fine.
Like, I respect art piece movies and I just like, I'm like, yes. But now I'm ready to go back and immerse in them.
To Kenny's initial point, though, having watched, you know, recently having watched the trailer for The Matrix and seeing Lana bring it and just be like, I'm going to blow your mind all over again.
Yeah.
I'm going to destroy this franchise for you again. And I hope you're okay with that. Is amazing. And I wish that people use their powers for good rather than evil.
Right.
Guys.
Yes.
Guys.
Use your powers for something. Use your powers for something. Like, please be fearless. If you're rich enough to be okay forever, please be more fearless. Like, if this really is the last thing you're ever going to make, but you're good, then fucking go for broke. Like, I had a fascinating conversation once with Gary Dauberin, who makes not fascinating movies at all. He makes, like, Annabelle movies that are fun. He makes roller coaster movies. And I remember going into this interview with Gary. He's written multiple Annabelles. He directed Annabelle Comes Home. Like, he's very much a tentpole of the Wandverse. He wrote It Chapter 2, which I don't like at all.
Chapter 2 is awful.
It's awful.
And
I remember going into that interview with him, I was like, I only have one question I'm really interested in asking Gary, which is that, do you have, like, what's your big swing you want to take? Like, you are in. You are in this prime dream position. You are, like, a screenwriter of record for, like, blockbuster horror of the 2010s. And I asked, and he was like, no, not really. Like, you know, I like a roller coaster, man. Like, I just, like, I like a theater man. I was like,
sure.
Okay. And you know what? Once I had the answer, I was good. Once I had the answer and was like, no, but what do you like? But there's got to be something that, like, ever since you were 16, you were like, if I was president, like if I was king of the world kind of thing. And he just doesn't have that. He just wants to keep making these, like, straight down the alley. And you know what? Bless him. Good for him. Keep doing it. But anybody who says they want to make something audacious, who is actually in the position to do so and doesn't like execute on that to the best of their ability, maybe it gets, the studio takes it from you, it gets fucking noted to death. Like, the thing that makes me so mad about like Justice League is the idea that it's talked about as anything audacious when it's just long. It's just long and depressed. Like, and yeah, we do depressed now. That's a thing we put in art. Thank God there can be like emotional and mental health nuance to things. But like, guys, this wasn't daring. It was just extra. Like, but
can I also, I want to add,
what the fucking Matrix, Jupiter Ascending?
No, wow. 100%. I want to add one other wrinkle to that too, because I don't necessarily think it needs to be so binary. Like, I think fact that, like, put your money where your mouth is, you know, Chris Nolan, and buy a movie theater or decide to become a
producer. I wrote an entire essay about this.
That supports a whole bunch of new filmmakers.
Yep.
You know, if you're so adamant and want to help with the filmmaking landscape, then do that. And not just him. This goes for every filmmaker.
No,
that has
anybody who is on the level of like, QT who is not doing what they
he's
can
buying
to
movie
actually,
theaters.
To,
I respect
to actually
that.
Put cinema in front of people the way Tarantino is. It's like, do you love this or not? Because this is your job, isn't it? Like, this is your industry. This is you putting nice air on chairs in your offices to support your workforce. Like, this is what you can do for these things. Martin Scorsese is... like, yes, director,
going
but
above
a,
and beyond.
A preservationist, an advocate of global cinema.
Absolutely.
Like, are you A-list and are you richer than God or not? Like,
Kenny,
do something interesting
did you have
with
something
it.
To say about that, Kenny?
Nothing you're saying I disagree with. I agree with every word you're saying. The flip side of the coin, and this is what I was like saying in the beginning, is I was saying like when I was like, it's hard. But I wasn't saying like it's hard because it's a big. Did we lose Jordan?
Yeah. No.
Oh no, we got her.
She's there.
I wasn't saying it was hard. Oh, she muted.
Okay.
I wasn't saying it was hard because it's a big lift.
Yeah.
I'm saying it's hard for two reasons. One, not everybody's a Wachowski.
Right.
Which
I
you
don't
guys
begrudge
know.
Them that.
Of
I'm
course,
just,
you. Everybody.
I'm not saying the people
like,
who want to take the cuts. I want them to take the cuts. But if people, you want to make. If you want to make down the line, I'm in for you. I back
sometimes,
you.
And then again, I'm happy he did this, and it's not nice to really shit on him for it. But like sometimes you're Colin Trevorrow and you're making the book of that guy.
Henry.
And the book of Henry.
Book of that guy.
And that's your big swing. And that is very clearly like this is my passion project. This is inside my bones. And like I think that definitely falls more into like the more power to him than the ha 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 what a loser category. So it's partially like, look, it's hard. Like, it's hard to do what the Wachowskis do. It's hard to do it, like, you know, to do
what
George
David Fincher
Miller does.
Or, yeah,
completely.
Sure.
Yes, I completely agree.
The second thing is, it is like, your story about Gary Dauberman's interesting to me because at some point when you do this and you work for other people for so long, you do start to like get into this mental health space, which is like, it is a job. Like it is a job. And the healthy way to go through this and make my living and not lose my mind spending 20 years trying to put together my passion project is to take the jobs that are given to me, do as well as I can.
Absolutely.
And be a mechanic. And like, it's depressing. Like it is an absolutely depressing moment when I started to realize like my crazy ass ideas from my 20s are things that I wouldn't even get near today.
Right.
You interesting. Know? Okay.
Like I don't have the guts. I don't have the time. I don't have like, I just don't have that brain anymore.
My only question is there a desire to, is like in the recognition of that, is there a desire to want to return to those things or is the desire gone as well? Because if you don't want it, I don't want that for you.
No, it's a good question, Jordan. The answer is I really think the ability is gone. Now, that doesn't mean I'm a worse writer.
I want to say I believe in you.
Oh, no, it's not that I'm a worse writer. It's that I'm a different writer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like I know.
That's fair.
Changed. Like, I think Evolve seems like I've become better in some way. But like, there are ideas I had when I was in my early 20s that were like, you know, like every writer who comes out here in their early 20s is around our age wants Charlie Kaufman.
For sure.
And there's one Charlie Kaufman. there's a reason there is really only one Charlie Kaufman. And we all tried. And now, you know, we've made our way and made our careers. And like, you know, you do what you can do at this point. But yeah, is the desire gone? That's a really hard question to answer. Cause like,
for sure.
You know, I have some crazy ass ideas that I think I can execute now, but the ones that are really out there,
you didn't know any better when you were coming up with them the first time.
Exactly right. The one about the anthropomorphic rabbit who is suicidal, who is actually a time traveler,
a short film I want to produce.
That sounds great.
Kenny.
What's the rabbit?
Great film. His name is Suicidal Bunny. I never gave him a name.
It's not going to happen. Somebody who's like on like as wanting to be a producer, and that is like what I'm building myself toward. I have screenplays that I've written, and they are all the most like, give me a four quadrant audience. This is a beatdown movie. The premise is what's a cool way for people to die, and then like writing that. Right. And I think they're fun, and I think they're really good. But I want to get fucking rich so I can pay people with Suicidal Bunny ideas to make their shit, because I don't have the Suicidal Bunny brain. I don't have the Bjork brain. And like, hey, like you said, Christopher Nolan, if you got that brain, why don't you create a film fund for people just like you to come up and have those opportunities? But like, look at Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, who have made The Endless and Resolution, and Synchronic was their biggest movie yet that they've done, that came out last year. What they can do with $25,000 to blow your fucking mind. I want to get super rich so I can give more than $25,000 to people to blow my fucking mind, because I am a populist, but like, I want the people who aren't me to thrive and do interesting things.
I think you're totally dead on. And I think, you know, the thing that's like, deep inside of me, it's very similar to what you're talking about, is this idea that populism in cinema is not what dummies think it is.
It's not simplistic.
Yeah. Anytime you want to have
a Transformers episode in some capacity, I am right there for you.
All right.
Yeah, well, I was going to say one other thing. I can't remember. Oh, don't give them too much money. That was the problem with this movie.
Yes.
This movie
didn't need this much money.
If this was a $15 million movie, probably would have been better.
It would have been better if it was a $5 million movie. The only movies that really work, and it's funny because, you know, people are saying, the Matrix is going to be like, I read the article you sent me, Phil. Mm-hmm. Matrix, you know, has that like, the new Matrix has that Gremlins 2 or Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Energy
commentary on how crazy it is that we are actually doing this at this point in our lives. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is weirdly this, like what this could be, Ninth Gate, right? It is
Texas Chainsaw
weirdly,
Massacre 2 is also good.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
it's weirdly like it could be this because he probably had what, $1 million to make that movie, and it like maybe And he just used every tool in his tool belt.
A movie that I talk about constantly, The Neon Demon, I think is a really good example of this. Because if you watch it with the director's commentary, I would highly recommend if you have any interest in this movie whatsoever. Because Refn, like, at least three or four times throughout the commentary, he reminds people, he's like, and remember, we're watching a comedy right now. In the most dry and like a apathetic way, he reminds people, it's okay to laugh. You're watching a comedy. Like he wanted every genre to exist in this movie, and he's having a lot of fun. And I could see, like, if you just dismiss it out of hand, that's completely fine if it's not your thing. But if you're willing to engage with all the things that it's trying to do, it is trying to make every kind of movie at the same time, which is to me a worthy big swing endeavor. But it also is so much cheaper than you think it is. Like, he talks like, he's like, well, at that point, at a certain point, he talks about like a wardrobe item. He's like, at that point, $500 was $1 million to me, and I just couldn't spend that. And so you're watching this movie that like is built around beauty and the worship of it, and like models and things that imply expensive and that imply money, fashion, you know, beauty, gorgeous women, nice restaurants, like photo shoots, spectacular. And he's doing it all on a shoestring. And also he's doing it with an actress who's 15 at the time, and Elle Fanning, and he asks her in the commentary, do you think it's weird to do this kind of movie at this age? And she, he's like, would you do anything differently now that you're 18? And she's like, you know, I think it makes it better that I'm this age. And he's like, honestly, I do too. Cause if you'd been 18 when I would have made this, I would have done a lot more to you. Like, I would have put you through a lot more in this movie, but because of the restraints, because of the constraints forced by the facts, the budget, the age of the starlet, he had to make different choices that I think completely strengthened the integrity of the movie. Because if he had been allowed to do everything he could have afforded to, or his imagination could have allowed him to with an adult of age actress, this movie would have been like a fucking hat on a hat. It would have been like, Jesus, we get it. I feel horrible. There's sexual violence probably here that I don't want to see. Like, it probably would have been past the point to a degree of exploitativeness that would have been like, actually, you've lost the plot and you're just like enjoying torture now. But because of the constraints he had and because of the corners that he had to cut, it actually made the movie better. And this movie, I think the Ninth Gate got to indulge too much.
Me too. I can't believe I just looked up the Neon Demon. I can't believe that movie's 5 years old.
I mean, if you would like
to,
if you'd like to spend hours learning about it, you can listen to the Neon Demon podcast that I do with Roxana Haddadi and William O. Tyler.
I will definitely check that out. I need to rewatch the Neon Demon. I saw it in theaters, and
I'm going to watch it with two friends next week.
I need to watch it again because I do remember post Drive. It does feel like Refn had this moment when everyone's like, "This is the guy."
Yep.
And then he made like two movies that everyone was just like, is this the guy?
I don't know what's happening here. Completely.
And I think that I need to watch Neon Demon again.
I would like for you to.
Yeah.
It felt less like, is this the guy? And more like the, oh, we didn't know he was doing this. Like, we didn't know we gave him. We gave you permission to do whatever you want, but we didn't think it was going to be this.
Well, it's like it does feel like Drive was obviously a moment, and it's a great movie.
A moment,
and it is interesting, Kenny, because it does feel like everyone's like, Drive's fucking awesome, but no one watched any of the movies.
No one watched anything from Denmark. So no one expected
that when he got his blank check with Drive, that he would go and make these movies that are completely, you know, alienating and strange. But so I want to rate this movie real quick, and then I want to get your thoughts on what we're covering next week, because I'm curious if you've seen it. I'm sure you've seen it. Maybe you've seen it. It's a horror movie, so I'm sure you've seen it. But
I hope I've seen it.
So I saw this in '99 in the theater. And I remember thinking, this is really boring, and I'm pretty sure I fell asleep. I probably would have given it a 40 back then, just because I just don't think that I certainly didn't like it, but like, I don't think I gave it much thought.
Yeah.
Before this podcast, I was at a 32. After this podcast, I'm at a 27. Like, this movie is just dropping as I continue to think about it, as we continue, because I think it's just, and I don't mean to sort of belabor the point, but I'll just say that it just feels like a wasted opportunity. Like, I think that we've been talking about this movie for over an hour, hour and a half now. And I do feel like,
and we mostly talk about other movies.
And we talk about other things too. But I will say,
but I mean, like, to the point, like, we're mostly talking about other movies when we could be talking about The Ninth Gate, because like, we're like, The Ninth Gate?
Well, but it's I think that we all agree that it's like, in the time that we've talked about it, that there's something here. It's just been wasted. Not just the money, but just like, there's a lot of talent here.
Yeah.
That's just not being capitalized on. Kenny, what did you think? Where are you at?
You know, what's weird, Phil, is I started in a very similar spot, 37. And before this, and I'm going up.
Exciting.
I'm going to go up to a 47.
Interesting.
I don't think this is a good movie.
Right.
But I also don't think, like, we talked about it. I don't think we avoided talking about it the way we avoid talking about some movies. And I think the things that we did talk about are kind of fond memories for me. The aftertaste of this movie is not as bad as I thought it would be, because going down, it's pretty bad. Like, if you're going to watch this movie, you're going to sit there and hate it and hate us.
Don't watch this movie, guys.
But after, it's like, if you really think about the silly and the funny and the goofy, it's not that bad. I'm going 47. That's what I'm going to win.
I have to shout out one moment in this movie that was, I think, maybe the peak of ridiculous to me, when Johnny Depp and the girl are, they're breaking into Mrs. Telfair's apartment.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Or sorry, hotel room, because they're going to steal back the book, but she's already left. And they get close to the door. They're at the door, mm-hmm. right as the bellhop inside is opening it to take out the bags, and they scurry off like they don't, they're not going to be seen. They are right in front of this man's fucking eyes. Are 6 inches away from his body squarely. And it's not like he opens it behind him and you just see his back and he turns and they're gone. He is standing right in front. All he's doing is slightly looking down, and two adult humans just go whoop and like Scooby Gang out of the way.
It's great.
And it's like, wait, he didn't see them? He didn't
this
see
is,
them.
But this is, again, this all just feels like it's all just tone that I'm like, yeah. Is this real? Or is
this, real? Yeah. Is this real?
What's your rating on Ninth Gate, Jordan?
I feel like I was probably, okay, I would say that when I first saw it coming into this, I was probably like a 40. It was just like, I'm not offended by what's happening here, but I'm barely entertained. But I think for me, it does go, I like Kenny's reaction. I think for me, it does go down to like a 30, 25, 20, okay. 27 because of it, because the question of the resources and the like, wow, when you have this much in your deck and you don't capitalize it, I feel almost a sense of offense the people who do so much more with so much less.
That's
if you're going to be a convicted rapist and have carte blanche in front of you, and you're going to make a snoozer with your cultural pass that you're getting, like, go fuck yourself in 7 more ways than I already thought. Go fuck yourself.
You're here. So next week,
47. That's what he gets.
Next week.
Yeah, I like your response. The value of this part of the post game.
Yeah.
It's an 80. This is a fucking 90.
There you go. That's like, the best part.
This is one of, like, there's a classification of movies that belongs in. My friend, the director Sam Weinman, hosts a weekly movie night where he does double features. And he came on Disaster Girls recently and we talked about Poseidon from 2006. And him and my co-host Amanda, they gave it 4 Tower Infernos, which is our evaluation system. I gave it 2. But I was like, you know what? It's a 2-tower movie.
How many is it
movie.
Out of? 5?
5 Towering Infernos.
Okay.
I was like, this is a 2-tower movie.
What does Towering Inferno get?
5 Towering Infernos.
Okay.
It got it. It landed. It stuck the landing. Okay. I was like, this is a 2 Towering Infernos movie with a 4 Towering Infernos conversational experience. Like, mm-hmm. I would have so much fun with a movie like this at movie night at Sam's house, where we are all shouting at the screen and turning it into a Midnight Madness experience.
Yes.
Because there's enough absurdity to have it be an engaging call and response and experience.
Totally.
For that, it is definitely like the movie itself remains low in its score, but the capital of interacting with the movie with a willing set of participants around you, high value, high
good
value.
Stuff. Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Yeah. So next week, Jordan, we are doing the movie Bats. Have you seen the film
Bats? I haven't seen Bats.
So
I assume Bats, it's animals, animal bats.
It is animal bats. That's right. It stars Lou Diamond Phillips.
Yes.
It's written by John Logan.
Okay.
It came out in October of 1999. And we're going to be talking about Bats next week with Danielle Savory and Barrett Doss from Station 19. They're coming back to talk about Bats.
Awesome.
All 91 minutes of it with credits.
I love that.
It's going to be great. Listen, Kenny and I have talked. We've been talking about doing Bats for a while now.
Bats are my greatest fear.
Are they really?
I didn't know that. Yes, yes. And they really look fucking crazy in this film. This is nightmare fuel.
I'm excited.
Oh, that's great.
This.
There's like,
oh my God,
like,
it has Dina Meyer too. Yes, oh, this is great news.
There's where a bat who looks like a pug is like,
wait, hold on. I gotta look up
mounting somebody.
I am this is a great poster.
They look like pugs, dude. They're like pug bats.
Oh shit. Yeah, no, these look great. There's also a sequel that came out in 2007 called Bats Human Harvest. More bats? They just should have called it More Bats.
More bats.
Bats here.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, I'm excited. I'm, you know, listen, bats. What's not to love?
It's a small town. That's,
you know, everything. Bats are the worst and the scariest.
Bats. I mean, I've never seen a bat in real life. Have you, Kenny?
Are you kidding? You didn't have bats at your camp?
No.
I've only seen them in flight. Like, I've never seen a bat up close.
Guys. Guys, I mean,
so when that little video goes around of Sattler the fruit bat, who's really old, on Twitter, do you get really upset, Kenny?
It really upsets Kenny.
Well, the thing about it, I mean, truly, I'm not afraid of almost anything. I'm scared to death of bats. They're disgusting. We had bats at camp, so we would like have like situations where they would like be flying around the mess hall and flying around the rec hall. And Norm Laxo, the head counselor, was like 60. Go after it with a broom.
I mean, if I saw one in real life, I probably, because I mean, obviously I've seen pictures of them and they are a very disturbing looking creature.
Sometimes they're adorable. Like the weird thing
they can
is
look
like
little puppies.
Little bears. They're the cutest sometimes. But and then apparently, thank God I wasn't there. Uh-huh. But at my parents' house in Westchester, my sister and brother-in-law went to go stay there.
Yeah.
And they found a fucking flapping bat like on the floor.
Jesus.
We have bats there, obviously.
It's so erratic and intense in its movie. It's very destabilizing.
And there's also something that they can see in the dark, like is also upsetting. Yeah, their wings are very skin like, which is upsetting.
Yeah.
And that you know that they can see you at night. Like, and that they have night vision all the time. That you're just
And Phil, you know they are the rabies guys.
They're the rabies guys. They're also the COVID guys.
They may be the COVID guys.
Did you see the thing that was going around recently that was like, it was going around on Twitter and somebody photographed, they're like, I went to put my headphones on and it felt weird and I took them off and I found this and there was a tiny bat curled up in the can of the headphone. A tiny bat.
That is nightmare fuel. Kenny
is coping.
That is fucking crazy.
And like, just like the little wing, it's all curled up.
You are
in the
talking
circle.
About my nightmares. Like, I just don't want bats in my life. So like, this is actually something that I think might scare me. I don't get scared at horror movies, but this is like that thing that like might fuck me up.
Here's what I'm excited about. There's a very real chance that this will be a live episode for us too. So we'll get to watch Kenny's reactions live.
Wow.
As we see
like this.
So
is
it becomes
payback.
Like a Mystery Science Theater style, like in real time. Gotcha.
Right. We'll be on Zoom watching bats potentially live with Danielle and Barrett. So Jordan, thank you so much for coming on and talking
about it. Thank you so much for having me again. I so enjoy talking with you guys.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs. And most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.